You're listening to Mom and Doc Talk, where we talk all things healing pans and pandas with an emphasis on homeopathy.
Hi, I'm Jody, the mom.
And I'm Dr. Barr, the doc, and welcome back to Mom and Doc Talk. We are really excited today. And I know I say that every episode, we're really excited, but we are super, super, super excited today because we anticipated that there was going to be a really great response to our episode on mold remediation with Michael Schrantz. And he was so generous as to be willing to come back to answer any questions that we might not have answered. As good as we are at predicting what people might want to hear, we don't predict everything. So we're here with Michael Schrantz back to answer questions from our community based off of the podcast, his original podcast. So if you haven't checked that out, check it out before you listen to this, just because it'll give you some really good background. It is episode 50. We'll put a link to it in the show notes if you want to check that out before you listen to the answers for the specific things that we're going to go through today. But before we go into the questions, let's do a quick introduction in case anybody's skipping that first episode. So Michael Schrantz is the owner and operator of Environmental Analytics LLC, located in Tucson, Arizona. Environmental Analytics is a comprehensive indoor environmental quality consulting company that covers a wide range of environmental assessments for the residential, commercial, and medical sectors. Mr. Schrantz has over 26 years of active indoor environmental quality and building science experience. He has been involved in over 6,000 related projects expanding across the globe. He is a board certified indoor environmental consultant, a CIEC, and board certified microbial investigator, a CMI, through the American Council for Accredited Certification. I always mess it up when I say it. Mr. Schrantz is highly recommended by treating physicians across the globe for his work with patients suffering from various forms of chronic illness, including CIRS, MCAS, MCS, SIBO, PANS, PANDAS, ALS, AD, and Lyme disease. He is highly involved in his industry, serving as a board member for the ACAC, ISEAI, and an actively involved member with the Surviving Mold and Sears X communities. He is a published author of Spore Trap Analysis and MPQ PCR Methods and has co-authored multiple publications and papers. Mr. Schrantz spends countless hours in consulting efforts, volunteers hundreds of hours every year to help educate the public, including in talking to us twice now, including his own podcast, IEPradio.com, which we'll have a link for you guys in the show notes as well. He is an active speaker at industry-related conferences and workshops throughout the world. Mr. Schrantz can be contacted at mike@environmentalanalytics.net, and the website is environmentalanalytics.net. So welcome, Michael. We are so, so thrilled to have you back. Like I said, it's one of our most listened to podcasts and that gets referenced regularly. And people will even say, like in our community where we interact with people in our Facebook group, people will say, you have to listen to this. They'll have questions about mold remediation. You have to listen to this podcast. You have to listen to this episode. So thank you for coming back and your generosity to answer the questions from our community. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, Jennifer and Jody, thank you guys. It's always a great opportunity. And I actually feel like it's such a great brain exercise for me and be able to give back like this. So you can feel free to fire away those questions. I know we have a limited time today, so I want to get as many as I can for you.
Yeah, fantastic. So let's start. We've got like this first one is like kind of a big question. It's a lot of questions basically around trying to find a home. We've got several questions about finding homes and safe places to live. So the overall view of this first question is, how do you buy or rent a home that is mold free? And then there's several sub questions. So do you recommend getting a mold inspection prior to buying a home? And is it done differently when you call someone who can do an ERMI because you suspect mold? And they were bringing this up because they said that they've recently seen some homes built or renovated that the framing has been exposed to rain. And then the minute it's sunny, people are back out there closing up the house and they're worried that there might be creation of mold happening in that process because they're just not really concerned about it. Yeah. So they're also curious if there's a protocol that building companies should be following to ensure that the framing is dried out. So there's a whole lot at once. Yeah. Start where you feel comfortable.
Yeah, no, I fortunately got that question in front of me or so I'd be lost, but I understand why. I get it. First of all, we know we don't use the term mold free. We know what you mean. We don't want an area of home that's got mold growing in it or did have mold growing in it, but we were looking for a house that reflects normal fungal ecology. We're breathing in mold spores and mycotoxins right now. So that's just a friendly reminder for those of you who may have not have really thought about it like that. Those same molds that we know can grow in a home and do grow in a home and can create mycotoxins, the same mold that originated outside that you're being exposed to That being said, the question is how, and it's typically complicated, right? I mean, there's multiple steps. I won't try to shamelessly plug my episode, but you know, it's free information for you all, is episode 25 on IEP Radio gets into what to consider when buying a home. And it's more of a strategical process, like working with a realtor and when to do the inspection periods, because it always gives you an opportunity to say, nope, this is too much. I mean, who cares if the house, it doesn't have mold in it, if there's no roof on the house. So, you know, you know, it's relative to a process. Episode 9 on the same podcast, IEP Radio, gets into things to consider when renting, which is really good for both buying and renting, because it gets into the idea of, are you looking at the outside, the landscaping, you know, is the drainage away from the house, that sort of thing? Are you seeing these classic indications of water damage, swelling, paint drooping inside of the home? Does the house smell musty? Is there a crawl space? But as an HVAC system, are you inspecting it? So I think the shorter answer might be, with some few tips here, is definitely take a look at those podcasts, but also, you know, there's free resources and there's minimally charged resources. Like, for example, survivingmold.com's got the buying a home document for like $7. And it really allows the person to kind of almost compare against different homes. But I think at the end of the day, it's what we want to be careful about is we're not running away from a house that's got a water stain. It's all about whether or not you think you can address that issue. If it's got a water stain underneath the kitchen sink cabinet, you wouldn't necessarily run from the home. You would just ask the question of, do I want to have it inspected? And yes, if there's time, absolutely you would do it. I think the question becomes, what do you do when you don't have a local inspector or an inspector that you don't trust or that you don't know you can trust?
That's a question about that too.
Right. Well, that's why you have a couple options. One is to work with somebody before you put yourself in that position. Do a virtual consultation with somebody like myself or others. You can go on ICI's website, for example, on their Get Help page. There's plenty of people that do virtual consultations. I do some of them as well, and can prepare you for that. Come up with a unique protocol. Are we going to have you do your own visual? Are you going to hire somebody? We're going to have you do your own MSQPCR, a DNA sample. You might know it as an ERMI sample. We might. Maybe it won't be that helpful to just do that sample. It might be misleading. What if you do a sample in that new home and it comes back elevated, but you find out later, maybe because you're psychic, that the reason it was elevated was because it was the housekeeper's or cleaner's moldy vacuum that caused it, and it had nothing to do with the home. Oh man, I just let that house go away because I had a false positive? Possible. Mm-hmm. So it's not as easy as, we could spend literally the whole hour talking about the process, but I'll tell you that it's, if you watch those episodes, it's meant to give you 9 and 25. It's meant to give you an idea of how to adjust it at steps so that you don't have to commit the whole thing. What's the whole thing? Well, who's going to fly in a $3,000 inspector to look at a home that they don't own? Most people can't do that. But a lot of times virtual consultations can help prepare you for, here's what you should do. Here's what you should be looking for. A lot of the stuff is the same thing you've heard, but it still boils down to, is there anything else you see? Like, I don't like houses with crawl spaces. I don't like houses with flat roofs. You know, we want drainage to be away from the house, like it's raining right now outside of our house. And there's one area that I live in my house that I got to go check after this and make sure that water's not pooling up, because, you know, you don't want that water to come into the building. But at the end of the day, if there's no visual evidence, it's really like, how do you feel? And one of the things that we've talked about also having people do, the last point I'll make on this, is VCS testing, vision, contrast, sensitivity. Some of you know it, some of you don't. And the idea is that you can look into that. Survivingmold.com promotes them all the time. Again, like $10 per sample. And this idea of doing like a screening while you're at the house. And we talk more about that in other episodes, but like, do a screening test outside. Be outside for 60 minutes. It seems weird, but let's get a baseline of what your VCS looks like. Some of you go, well, I've done it before and I always fail them, or I never fail them. We're not looking for pass or fail. We're looking for deltas, differences. If you failed or passed this much, how much did you fail or pass that much when you were in the house after at least 30 minutes, but usually 60 minutes? So take a look at those.
That's the first time I've heard somebody recommend that as like a little tool to give you an idea about how that particular area is impacting you.
There is the Sears X community, which their information is free. If you go onto their resources page, you can go down into conferences and you find Boulder, you'll find my wife, Jennifer Schrantz, who did, she's a realtor and works for people with CIRS. And she literally did this thing for what to do when looking for a home. And she literally breaks that down into detail for a person. Cause some of you are going, my God, Mike sounds like an auctioneer right now. Forgive me. but if you watch that episode, I helped her create it. You'll walk and see the process of what, like, real time, up to date, what we're having people do. And it gives you it all while we're talking or afterwards. I'll send you the link if I can find the actual video.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. I didn't know that the the visual contrast sensitivity, the VCS test, I didn't realize that it was that quick that you could have a change from like outside to inside.
Optic nerve, according to the research from Shoemaker, is that column E can show inflammation of that nerve, if you, and that inflammation can happen that quickly in a home. Is it foolproof? No, but there's not one thing that's foolproof. Yeah. One test, one blood test, one urine test, nothing's foolproof, but it's a good indicator and it's cheap, is that you could do it. And if you go in the, if you're out of the house and you're in your car walking around the neighborhood, and let's say that you score a certain percentage in this column, and then it's worse after being in the home for 60 minutes, that could be an indicator. Now, would you walk and move away because of that from that home? Maybe, maybe not. What if it's compiled with other things? Like, you know, I didn't really know if I was on the fence with this home. It's got a crawl space. And then you add up all these other things. You start to go, you know what? The overall score of this home, when you combine it all up, just seems to have too many boxes checked off on the wrong spots. And so then you move on to the next home. We don't know any other way to do it without asking the homeowners, hey, do you mind if we borrow your house for 30 days and do some experiments? No one's going to let you do that typically.
I think it's fantastic that like you say it as many times as you need to, the normal fungal ecology, because I think that that's something that people need to hear again and again and again. I've talked about it, but I'm not a mold expert per se. I'm very, very good at helping people become less susceptible and reactive to mold using homeopathy, but I'm not a mold remediation expert. I'm not any of those things. And I think it's vital that we keep reminding ourselves and other people that there is no such thing as mold-free. It's normal fungal ecology, and figuring out how that we can be as little reactive to the normal fungal ecology as possible. Yeah. And I just also, like, if I were to have introduced you without your bio, with all of your professional accolades, I would have added in there that you are somebody who is really good at taking things and simplifying them, even though you use a lot of really big words and speak like an auctioneer. You simplify them and give people this perspective of like, this doesn't have to be all or nothing. This doesn't have to be the end of the world. It doesn't have to be super stressful. And I really appreciate that. And that's, you've already started that way with this first answer that you've given us to help give that context of like, it doesn't, like, just because you see something, it doesn't mean that it is a big, big problem.
One of the things our industry did wrong, you're right, is not calibrate that context part. We just were data, 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 info, information overload. And to the point where people don't even know how to be human again. We're just robotic because we're so numb and in that flight or fight and worried because you hear these things. And I'm here to tell you, it's not like that, but it doesn't help that a lot of our industry, I'm not including us three in this call, but are not helping. Some unintentionally, they're just kind of naive or ignorant, but other people, it's fear mongering. It's like, they know that I can get you all worked up, I can charge you quite a bit of money to solve your problems for you. And we just don't operate that way. And nor do a lot of the good people in the industry.
Yeah. Yeah. Michael, what type of, are there certain types of homes to avoid that are more mold prone? Like, what kind of homes seem to have less water damage to them?
Sure. If I was to look at the question, like which ones am I most likely to find issues with, it would be in no particular order because they're all low-hanging fruit to me. Homes with crawl spaces, homes with basements, finished basements versus unfinished basements, houses with flat roofs, and homes, no matter what their construction, in very humid climates. Not to say that they have to have a mold problem, but they have the added challenge of dehumidification issues or condensation issues, rather, creating conditions conducive for mold growth. So your Miami, Florida, is your tropical climates, Georgia, you know, these sorts of places are prone to having challenges. You don't even have to have a water leak. You could just have a real big problem with condensation that can then be an HVAC system issue in your ductwork, that sort of thing. Those are absolutely the lowest hanging fruit. You can move out to Arizona, even though it's raining right now, and it's pretty dry, but you still have roof leaks. We have a flat roof, and I've had four different mold remediation projects in my home. It didn't run, dealt with them. And beyond that, I would say, you know, some people ask about age, construction, you know, years and all that sort of thing. And it's kind of a weird thing because we used to say, like a decade ago, we would say things like, well, you know, newer home is better because it's had less chance in the market for opportunities for history of leaks and this and that and the other. And then to the point of the other second half of that first question, it was like, well, what about when it's being built and builder doesn't care? And with the construction materials we have today versus back when we used real wood that didn't have adhesives and we used plywood instead of oriented strand board or what's known as OSB. What we used to say to people is, you know, go newer, but then it was like, then we would say, well, go older, you know, because yeah, it had more chance of leaks, but it was the building materials were more solid. You had solid cabinetry, solid walls, again, not made with OSB and dry, it was plastered walls, not drywall. Well, the problem with that statement now is not necessarily that it's not true. The problem is a lot of those homes have been remodeled. And so they are having the newer building materials. And so it's really hard to say the year. And I think you have to treat all homes the same. And as you know, I'm not to open up another thing, but there's more to consider, excuse me, issues like a newer home might off-gas chemicals. Anybody here sensitive to chemicals? And so it's like, do we go with an older home that's been established, you have time to kind of off-gas a lot? Maybe that means more to you than buying that brand new home that makes you feel like, well, it's only been on the market for a month. Or in the environment for a month. So I'm inclined to believe it's not had a bunch of plumbing issues. So there's no one right answer. There's no one perfect home.
Yeah. It's like you read my mind. I was like, okay, I got to ask him what year. And I was like thinking, is my older home like within the year?
Mine's 1975. And I'm blessed to say that minus those four leaks, house is built pretty solid. I've seen homes that are 2020 have had more problems than this.
Yeah. Mine's 1978. So it's fairly solid house. I actually think we didn't fully answer, and it's my fault because I was excited to move on, the question about whether or not there's protocols that building companies should follow to ensure that the materials are dried out when it's getting rained on.
I'm not aware of if there's a protocol that companies are to follow. And I don't even know that there's a protocol that's established that they should follow to ensure the framing is dried out. However, I would argue that if you are doing with new construction where they are building a home for you, I think the issue is can you have an independent party come out there and monitor the moisture conditions, especially in any sort of a rainy or snow environment? Because I just don't know of a builder. I'm sure there's exceptions out there, but that's going to go out of their way and go, hey, it's rainy. Everybody get their moisture meters and let's go out and bring our fans and dry out the wood. The mentality in that industry is more like it's outside, it'll dry out naturally. That's what Mother Earth is for. And unfortunately, we do see that happen a lot. And, you know, sometimes it, depending on the climate, it doesn't really affect it that much. But in other cases, we've seen mold grow a lot. In fact, we've seen horrible situations where basements that have been covered. So they have the floor joists and they have the OSB, which represents the floor of the upper level. It got wet, rainy. And then if that perfect little kind of boxed basement area and then mold starts growing everywhere. So I don't know of any actual standard that they should be following. I think the issue is can you hire either an IEP like myself, and doesn't have to be me, it could be just a good old fashioned pump jockey guy that has a moisture meter, or a mold remediation company who knows how to use a moisture meter. And if you can't find that, do it yourself and be your own advocate.
Yeah.
And there are dry standards out there, by the way. You can look them up easily, like dry standard for pine or OS, like what is a standard, and to see what's acceptable. And depending on the type of moisture meter you use, which is another 1 hour conversation, you will typically find that you could even take your own handhold one and know if something's wet, it's usually going to spike and you're not even going to be dealing with the gray areas. It's going to be either like it's wet or not wet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What about when finding a new home, is the best method ERMI, or are there other things that we can purchase or consider purchasing prior to, or that something that we can purchase from the store that we can use prior to purchasing the house?
Yeah, I mean, MSQPCR sampling, or what people know as ERMI, and we're starting to shoo away from the term ERMI because of the negative connotation of the ERMI score. We do not look at the ERMI score. There's not saying there's not people that do, but we definitely don't. Very misleading. It's very hard to get an ERMI score of a zero. And even if you had an ERMI score of a zero, the scale goes like negative 10 or 20 all the way up to like positive, you know, other direction. Even if you had a score of a zero, that still puts you in a 50% chance of having a mold burden in the home. That's not calibrated for people like us. It wasn't even its intention for that. That being said, I do think it is a really good tool to use those two episodes I mentioned to you in that video presentation that my wife did definitely gets into this idea of doing that type of a DIY dust sample. In my experience, in my opinion, I think it's, if you could only pick one test, Jody, I think it would be an MSQ-PCR dust sample, an ERMI sample, if that helps you guys remember, because you could do Petri dishes, but Petri dishes don't do non-viable. They don't identify fragments. They take time, more time. They can take more time to grow. And then maybe there's a time limit to where at least with ERMI samples, you can expedite the sample if you're under time crunch. But beyond that, you know, I would definitely choose, you know, ERMI samples over Petri dishes. I definitely choose Petri dishes over spore trap samples. And I feel like if you get all three of them, then you'd really have a good fuller picture of the environment, because they all have strengths and weaknesses. And there's not one perfect test. Yeah. And I think that's why testing, by the way, not to negate the question, but that's only one aspect of looking at the home. It's also the visual aspect. I use that example of the house cleeper's dirty vacuum. I mean, you don't put all your eggs in that basket. In fact, this is why you see so many people on Facebook and other social media groups asking questions about their ERMI. It's like, it's so hard to interpret them. There's no context. And it's just a bunch of people who've heard a few things about Stacky or a couple other molds, and they're assuming it's bad. Now, don't get me wrong. There's some that are so obviously elevated. I don't really care how you took the sample. It probably doesn't look good, but it gets into these questions of how much weight should I put into it? In an ideal world, you'd have an inspector who knows how to collect the sample and, more importantly, how to interpret them. And if you don't know where those people exist, go to ICI and try to find them. And if you don't know where to go there, look me up, because I happen to interpret them all the time.
Right. Well, I think is in the PANS community, as moms, we're looking for the utopian scenario, right? The best possible thing. And it's interesting, y'all, we're talking about the age of your house. You know, we went through mold. My kids were so sick. We specifically were looking for a brand new house, found a brand new house, moved in. We've had two major mold exposures since then and one minor. Our plumbing was not hooked up correctly. And so it's like there's no matter the amount, there's just no perfect place that we're going to find. Right. And testing, we could have tested this house when we moved in, and we're, you know, it still happens.
The amount of awareness, to your point, that has come up over the years of, you know, look for this and look for this, has in its own, like, manifested its own. I'm probably going to butcher this, ladies, but I'll try to say, it's like not desensitized, but it's created. And okay, I'll keep it simple. It's created an expectation that's impossible. It's there's no such home. Yeah. And you gotta ask yourself that, like, if you're listening right now going, yeah, let's think about this. Like, if I follow every recommendation and it has to be perfect or lacking, there's no way you're going to find a home like that. We're talking down to the nitty gritties, like, oh, okay, well, it doesn't have a crawl space, but the draining's not perfect outside. Oops, guess I got to walk. Or everything looks good, except there's that water stain on that bottom shelf in the kitchen sink cabinet. Oh, got to walk. No, you don't have to walk. It's welcome to earth, but this is no fault of your own. This is what the industry is teaching you without context. And you're just like sitting here with all this raw information, and you're supposed to somehow know how to weight it. That's the problem with the industry, is people don't know how to interpret it or add weights to it. And even we struggle. That should tell you something. It's like, well, how do we know? Is this house safe for me? I don't know. I have to ask your DNA. Right. You know, well, there's we found Stacky, Mike. It was 14 in there. I don't know. Is 14 good for you? Well, I don't know. Isn't that a high number? Oh, can be. And by the way, I'm not a fan of having 14 counts of anything like that in the home. My point is, it is not black and white. Normal fungal ecology has changed in your car, in your home, in your office, wherever you're at right now, 20 different times since we started this interview, a little bit. And if there was a large gust of wind that just hit your house, maybe a lot of it. And so that's the problem with this issue, right? Is people are out there saying things of what's safe, what's not safe, but it's changing all the time. And it's the same species that we're being exposed to. Why is it that when Stacky botrys lands from outside, lands on my t-shirt, I don't worry about it? But if it's in my house and it lands on my t-shirt, I treat it like it's contamination. Why are we making the house defining whether or not it's a problem? I'm only humoring that point, Jennifer, that you said earlier about that kind of that reconfirmation that it's not so black and white, but that's actually a relief. Yes. It's like, oh, so we don't have to be that critical? No, you don't. Don't cut corners. Don't be silly. Don't go lick the mold with the wall with mold on it. But let's not freak out when we have a little bit of topical mold in your toilet tank. That's every toilet. And yeah. and we'll bring this up later in the questions, but we're seeing a lot of that too. A lot of inspections with inspection companies that are calling out things that are so ridiculous that we might as well have you rip out all your plumbing. I kid you not, all your drain line, because you probably have a little bit of bacteria mold in there too. So you should probably run from that. And I hope that when you guys hear this, it's met with some sense of relief and clarity where you might be confused of, oh my gosh, how worried should I really be here? And we'll dive more into some of that.
Yeah, I was going to say, so let's say that we've already made the decision. We've found the house that like has things we can live with, and we are now working on managing and making sure that we're on top of things and not ignoring things that need attention, but not freaking out about things that do, and then figuring out like if something's appropriate or not. So how often should we be checking for mold?
Yeah, you know, not a set rule, but a lot of times when this question comes up, we'll tell people, you know, listen, if you're doing good with your health and it's more of a, as long as it's a proactive thing, you're not reacting to this, meaning you're not doing this in an anxious, worried, flight or flight type issue, but it's more like, I just want to be on top of things. You consider doing it every 6 months. Some people do it every season because as the season changes, the weather changes. As the weather changes, your house communicates with the outdoors a little bit more differently, like summer versus winter, for example. That's two totally different communications of air movement in and from the home because of heat temperature differentials. So I would say at a minimum, once every 6 months. Some people like to be a little bit more diligent and do every season. And for those of you who are doing really good and you are being diligent, like Jennifer said, you're checking, you know, I got my moisture alarms and nothing's going off and I'm paying attention. I don't see any water stains, maybe once a year. It really boils down to you, the individual. That's why it's so custom made, because I wouldn't tell somebody who's really, really sick or ill, who's really at the, you know, their bucket's full and they're really just needing that, you know, extra special attention, do it once a year. I might have them do it once every couple months in line with whatever their clinician is doing to make sure that we're kind of coming up with useful information that will help them and the doctor make decisions about their treatment.
Yeah, absolutely.
What about tools we can purchase from the local hardware store that are good for moisture detection?
I think the only thing that you can really do, it's a great question, by the way. In fact, that's come up before with other venues. The only thing that you could do when you think about local hardware store is find a moisture meter that gives you like a relative scale. This is the one that doesn't necessarily give you like this much percent of moisture content or whatever. You're going to spend a lot of money for those moisture meters, $150, $200 and up. There's some meters that are $500, $600. But if you're talking about the $40, $50 special, they have those non-invasive moisture meters that have the pads on there. And a lot of times they'll give you a scale, a reference scale. And what we love about, I use those, I have a $300 version of one, but it's the same concept because a lot of times when you have these, it's not about trying to say this one has 3.7% moisture content. You don't care as a homeowner. You save that for the professional. What you want to know is that wet? Like when my moisture alarm went off a half an hour ago in our HVAC closet, I had to figure out if I had a roof leak from the rain right now. So I took my scale moisture and I went around and I scaled it. And you do it by comparing it to other areas. If this area, I'm looking at a wall by a window, is, I think, wet, you put the moisture meter next to it. And then you say, okay, this is what it is, whatever the level is. And then I'm going to go do a control. Like maybe it's on the same wall, but a foot to the right. So it's away from that area. Or maybe it's another similar wall, like in another exterior wall, another interior wall, and use that to help you. Those are good. You don't need a $300 moisture meter for that. Keep in mind, because a lot of people don't know this, metal will produce a false positive. So if you're running your moisture meter along a window frame and you're hitting that corner bead that's made out of metal, it starts beeping at you. It doesn't mean you have moisture in the wall necessarily. It could just mean that you're hitting metal.
Yeah.
I'm curious if there are any portable mold testers for air contamination that you think are useful, or, I mean, is that even important, knowing that we have varying normal fungal ecology?
When we say portable, do we mean DIY, or do we mean DIY, take a sample and send it to a lab or a machine or a meter that gives you some sort of instantaneous result?
I believe the person who asked the question meant sort of a meter that gives you an instantaneous result, like that you could take with you and say, I'm not feeling great, check the air, is mold high right now?
I see. Well, there are devices that are not, they're commercial units. They're not that you would buy yourself, you know, that people have that claim that there's a device that will come to me, but again, it's a commercial unit, so I won't waste your guys' time. That supposedly is pretty real time. But no, the closest thing I know that you could get to something that would be real time would be something that is doing indirect measurements of mold structures by way of either like a VOC meter that might be able to detect microbial VOCs. Again, we're talking real time because there is a difference. If I get the opportunity of using a lab, that changes things. But real time meter, you're probably going to be better off with just what are other factors like particulate counts and things of that nature. And that's going to be a little bit disappointing, because just because your particle counts are high doesn't mean that your mold counts are high. So I don't think there's anything reliable that I would recommend that wouldn't have you more confused by the end of it than actually helpful.
Right. I love what you say, that have you more confused by the end of it than actually helpful, because also, even if you got the information and you understood it, what are you going to do about it in the moment?
This is the problem. Like it's not a smiley face thing, right? Like a lot of indoor air quality devices, it's smile. Oh, my indoor air quality is smiley or frowny or neutral. Based off of what metric? Based off of somebody with CIRS, MCAS, the list goes on. Or could it be that it's a proprietary formula that's not based off of chronic illness, but more of like big picture health stuff that anybody would want to have? And then the other issue, of course, are false positives. If anybody on this call has ever had a portable indoor air quality meter, they know how many, or a sensor on their air purification device, they know how often it will go up if you start cooking or you turn on your humidifier at night. Your house isn't contaminated, although the thing's starting to glow red, indicating that you should turn the machine up to high. It's because you have particle counts that are elevated. So what do you do with the information? And I can't tell you how often we say, well, my indoor air quality is bad. In the kitchen area around dinner time. And we're like, what are you cooking? Why wasn't I invited?
Right. It's interesting to me. I feel like we've gotten so many really great devices to help us understand our environment and our bodies and all of these things. And I feel like in some ways it's made us stop listening to ourselves too, because the reality is, like, if you don't feel good in a certain environment, leave the environment. And like, whether your meter tells you that you don't, that it's mold as high, like regardless, whatever it is. I mean, I understand like learning what something is so that you can ideally deal with it. But again, as you've said, not going to
want the validation, right? They want the validation, Jennifer, right? They want to go, aha, and there's what it is. Yeah. But you said everything you said, I couldn't. And then what? Yeah. And then what? Yeah.
As a doctor, like so many times I'm like, yeah, we could run a lab for this. And yes, we could run a lab for this. And then what? Does it change anything with what we're going to do? Let's especially, for so many people, like one of the biggest things for mold and mold remediation is the overwhelm of the cost. And it's like, let's not look for, at least in my opinion, let's not look for a lot of things that aren't going to change what we're going to do.
Yeah. Sampling is everything you said, including asking that question, is what value is it going to, what question is it going to answer that I can't answer with visual observations or symptoms that you trust? And oftentimes I find that in my personal experience, I find that the visual evidence or historic evidence and what I can do with it is about 50-50, or it offers the same amount of value than good sampling can. And we don't always do sampling. Sometimes we don't even have the option to.
Yeah. I'm learning on this one because I didn't even know this was a thing. What do you think about encapsulation with mold paint?
We generally don't support encapsulation. And I say generally, I should probably have said, I don't even know that I can count on one finger or two exceptions that would allow for it, but we're not trying to encapsulate mold. Number one, because first of all, it's ironic that a lot of the encapsulants that they recommend putting would require that you clean the surface first. If you put an encapsulant on mold growth, first of all, the primer, the paint, the chemicals aren't able to adhere or bond to the wood and the substrate to do the job it's intended to. So eventually it'll flake off. And the other thing is I can't tell you the number of times where we've seen homes personally and from colleagues where they'll take a picture of a house where they open up a wall, it had been encapsulated before, and there's mold growing right through the encapsulant. People have misused and abused encapsulation. Source removal is key. Now, some people ask that same question, Jody, about prevention. Okay, never mind, Mike, we got a clean wall, but we don't want there to be mold growing in the first, in the future. Okay, well, let's talk about that for 30 seconds. If you need to put an encapsulant on in a wall cavity to prevent mold from growing and it grows there, you haven't solved the moisture problem. If you haven't solved the moisture problem, it doesn't matter whether you put an encapsulant on there, mold will still grow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So another question that came up with a couple of people is about things on the outside of the house. So like on the roof, if you think about, you know, here in California, we got solar panels everywhere, and you do too in Arizona, right? Mm-hmm. Solar panels have any impact on moisture growth or issues that could affect people inside, or people who maybe live in like more wet areas and have lichen growth regularly on their roofs? Are those things that people need to be concerned about?
So the question I'm hearing is we have is can I kind of heard two things, but then you said the lichen thing, which threw me. When I hear solar panels, I hear more penetrations on the roof, more points for water to get into your house. So that's okay. One thing is it is definitely more penetrations, more opportunity that way. In terms of having panels on the roof, that might create conditions more conducive for microbial growth. Sure. Do you need to worry about it? I don't know. I need to talk to your DNA first. But I will tell you that it's not like you're on the roof. And again, you know me, sometimes I use examples to illustrate points. It's not like you're rolling around sucking in the water and the lichens. You know, you might have some diluted stuff coming off of you. Some of you guys live in environments where you have growth, algae growth, and all kinds of macro fungi and things like that growing on the outside, and you really can't do anything with it. You know, some of you guys that are tucked in the forest and stuff like that, surrounded by high trees, know what I'm talking about. And it's like, we wouldn't tell you to burn the forest down. You just kind of live with, that's your background. That's your normal, you might call it, that's your normal microbial ecology. So I'm not saying that you shouldn't worry about it, but it wouldn't be a low hanging fruit to me. That would just be like, oh, you have this growth here. You can choose to clean it off and try to dilute it. But number one, there's going to be exposure to the cleaning. And number two, what are you going to do when it comes back in a month? You know, so how do you prevent it from happening? I think outdoor growth is what you can just sort of refer to as Mother Nature. And if it's an issue because it's where you live and it for some reason doesn't work with you, like maybe you have bad allergies or there's something that's just an issue where, you know, it's an exterior thing, probably got to look at moving or some sort of serious filtration in the home to see if you can manage it.
Mm-hmm. I'm actually curious if you have solar panels on your home or if you don't, if you would get them or if that's like a not so good thing.
My wife and I have talked about doing it for years, and we've talked about if we were going to do it, we would definitely not put it on the house. We would put it as a shade cover in the corner. So that way it would never penetrate our house and also offer shade at the same time.
Okay. So let's assume that we're taking our house and we're doing all our checking every 6 months, maybe more if we've got chronic illness or things that we mm-hmm. need to be concerned about. And then you find that you have a water event in the house or maybe one that's more obvious that you don't have to check for, something like a dishwasher exploded all over your kitchen. I'm guessing that the person who submitted this particular question had that happen. and then they took all, like if you take all the recommended precautions, like an industrial blower fan and dehumidifiers for 3+ days, removing cabinets from sheetrock to ensure that there's no trap moisture, ensuring a moisture meter reads dry on all porous surfaces. Are there any further recommendations for testing or checking to make sure that there isn't any mold growth? Basically, if you did everything right after a major water event, do you need to recheck?
The only thing I didn't hear was how quickly did they start drying everything out? But can we just assume less than 24 hours?
I would assume with a dishwasher exploding that it happened like right away.
Right. I know this explosion. Person. It was in 24 hours.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I think they've answered their question because they set the parameters in such a way that there only is one answer. They had a leak. Fine. That's fine. It's not an emergency. Well, it mm-hmm. could have been. They got on it quickly. They used industrial blowers and dehumidifiers for 3+ days, even removed cabinets from sheetrock to ensure there was no trapped moisture, so forth and so on. Did a moisture meter on all surfaces. Then they've answered the question because they must have dried it out. I think the elephant in the room with that question is, well, do you think you did a good job, enough job drying all the areas? And if the answer is, yeah, we were on top of it, then no, I wouldn't trip over myself and have you do additional mold sampling. If the client came to me with that same story, then said, well, here's the deal, Mike. I did all that. And I felt worse afterwards. And I would say, okay, was it because you were fatiguing out or tired from all of that extra work? It's possible. But I talked to my doctor, Jennifer, and she said that maybe, you know, it could be some mold thing. Of course, we'd have you retest. But do I think it's going to come from that recent leak that you were so proactive about? No.
Yeah.
You know, it's got to be, we talk about mold being able to grow in 24 to 48 hours, but that's ideal conditions too. And if you're blowing air around and moving things out and moving cabinets out of the way, you're starting to create a really unideal environment very quickly, which is a good thing for you and a bad thing for the mold or bacteria.
Yeah. How do you vet your mold professional to determine if they know what they're doing and if their work will be safe for mold sensitive folks?
God, great question. Tough one. I don't know that you'd ever be able to vet them 100%. And that's probably the most disheartening thing you can tell a person, but there are resources to help with that. Episode, I'm cheating and I had to go look. Episode 28 on IEP radio. What does a good IEP inspection look like? Bam, there you go. Well, take a look at that. You're going to find out that it's not going to be me talking about, hey, this is the flashlight you need to have, not that one, or this is the moisture. It's not that. Everyone's got the same moisture meter, got the same ideas of sampling. It's going to be the issue of critical thinking, listening to what you're having to say, not having the attitude of, unless it's proven it's not there, but more of the inspector, like Sherlock Holmes type thing, like a little bit of evidence, you pursue it, that kind of a thing. There are resources like ICI, again, ISEAI.org has that resource page, which typically has people that have been, I wouldn't say necessarily vetted, but they've definitely gone through a criteria to meet full membership, which allows them to be publicly listed as a potential source. But no one's perfect on there. I'm not perfect on there. But I think that that's what you can do to help. If you find that someone's like giving you a flat fee, how much it costs for you to come out and do my house? That's kind of a yellow flag for me. It's like, how would they possibly know what it's going to cost to check your home? What if I'm out there for an hour versus 3 hours? I don't know how long I'm going to be out there. Well, that includes two spore trap sample. That's a red flag. How do you only take two air samples, one outdoor and one indoor for my house? And so there's these flags. It's really, you want somebody who's almost going to have OCD. Like they're going to be like, oh, we're going to check every inch of it. And you want to be more worried about they're going to overcharge you for too much. That's a good problem to have. Because that at least means that they're going to really be critical thinking. The other thing you want to make sure is that you can interview them up front and ask them things like, hey, listen, what's your thoughts on cavity samples? Because a lot of companies won't do cavity samples. It's like, oh, we'll just take a spore trap sample a foot away from the wall that we think might have a source. And it's like, that's not going to help you. Yeah. Unless there's like a explosion that goes off that releases that mine of spores violently, that spore trap sample is not going to collect that kind of accumulation in something that's been wet, you know, whatever, hidden source. So I think those are a few examples to do that. And of course, the other thing to look for is somebody with recommendations. When you write my report, will you just say that there needs to be recommendations and follow an industry standard? Or do you write step-by-step protocol? That's a huge one. You want them to literally write out step-by-step protocol for you so that a local remediation company can follow that work. If they're not going to do that for you, probably going to disappoint you one way or the other.
Yeah. And I think a pan-specific answer to that would be going to your local groups, Facebook groups, and asking people about who you've used, because moms will tell you who they've had a good experience with, who they've had a bad experience with. So that's another one too.
Tell you what, word travels quickly. Yeah.
Yeah. And what about, how do you know how much needs to be done? I had an excellent mold specialist do testing. The remediation team didn't think that it all needed to be done.
That sounds like a client I just had. I don't know. Who do you trust in that example? Did you trust the remediation or the mold specialist? Because that's who I would go with. You know, why didn't the remediation company think a portion of the stuff that the mold specialist found needed to be done? If you told me because the mold specialist wanted me to remediate a toilet tank that had mold growing in it, I agree with the remediation company. You don't need to do that. That's ridiculous. If you said something that was, you know, or here's a better one. Mold on a grout in a tile shower. Need to remediate the shower is what the mold specialist says. Mold remediation company goes out there and go, shower wall looks like it's been built with integrity, has proper moisture backing behind the tile. Shower gets used on a regular basis. Of course, it's going to have mold on it. I don't see any reason to have to open up the shower and rip it off and charge you $15,000 or $10,000 to do that. I would tend to probably agree with the remediation company. And I might even throw in a safety net and say, hey, why don't we do a couple inspection holes on the backside of the shower? Because there's a common wall, it's drywall. We can just open it up real quick, see if we see anything. That costs pennies on the dollar to do that. So I don't know that you know. It boils down to education and reasonable rationale. And unfortunately, that's why you typically depend on the professionals. And unfortunately, they don't have a resource for that one that really gets into when to differentiate between who to trust. Honestly, at that point, you're working with a consultant typically like myself or others like me. I do that. The most common thing I do in my career is review reports and remediation protocols and try to find the balance of what works.
Yeah.
So speaking of one of the things that you just said, where you could like just check, take a couple of samples behind the shower wall. One of the questions that we had that had a lot of questions in it, I'm trying to like boil it down a little bit, was basically, is there a way to figure out if there's mold in the walls without tearing the walls down? Or is that really a vital component?
Well, there are non-intrusive indicators, like mycometer is a non-intrusive enzymatic test that looks for fungal enzymes that you sample, like maybe where the wall in question meets the floor, as long as there's some sort of a gap or crack. Some walls are sealed, but a lot of them are not traditionally, and you see that. There's another one by John Banta that does his pathways. Same idea. It's looking for protein peptides or peptide bonds that are produced by a lot of things, but commonly mold bacteria, and you can sample that. Those are non-intrusive, but those are indicator mm-hmm. things, and a lot of times we'll result to those when, in fact, we can't get into the wall itself.
Okay. So let's say somebody's had a remediation done and they test again afterwards and the mold counts come back higher after remediation. Mm-hmm. So basically like a botched remediation. Yeah. This person is curious what usually causes it. They were wondering if it's that the mold problem was the source of the mold problem was corrected, but the containment wasn't done well. And it's related to like the rest of the belongings need to be clean, or is it something else? And they're curious what the best thing to do is if they have a botched remediation and they've already spent a ton of money, so don't have a lot of wiggle room in their budget.
Or you kind of having a good team in the beginning to really help you, because when there's a term, it's something hits the fan. When that happens, you really want to have somebody who, like, what's that baseline? And was the testing done, like maybe to the person's point, the baseline testing didn't involve a containment. It was just the house as is. Then they have these results, but then they set up containment. They say, hey, we're done. They retest. Let's just say inside outside containment are a lot worse. Yeah, it's possible that they botched the job. I mean, why all of a sudden did it elevate it? Did you do something different? Is it a different sample methodology? Did all of a sudden somebody use a leaf blower on the retest and elevate levels in the air more than normal? Assuming it was more of an apples to apples comparison, I would be inclined as a professional to believe it had something to do with the remediation work. And I'm looking at other factors too. I'm looking at, well, look, tell me about the integrity of the containment. Well, you know, the corner fell down, the tape was starting to fall apart. Okay, well, that's a yellow flag. Kind of negative air, did they exhaust it to the outside? Well, no, they had a zipper, you went in and out, but there was nothing going to the outside. They had a scrubber running, but they never blew anything outside. Okay, so they didn't have negative air containment. It's all adding up to where it would be more likely than not that they caused the issue. We see that all the time. And if it's one of those deals where the containment passes, but the area outside all of a sudden is grossly elevated, that could still be an issue where it's like, well, yeah, because did they have guys going in and out with moldy contaminated suits, Tyvek suits or contents? But yet they did do a good job cleaning the containment area, but they didn't have, you didn't pay them or they didn't ask you if you wanted them to do it to clean the areas outside the containment. So they kind of left all this nasties outside of it. And that happens. And, mm-hmm. and if you're working with a good IEP and you have time to prepare for that, you know, you get into those questions up in advance. So that way, if that does happen, which it sounds like it might've happened with this person, then you have some sense of recourse. And the remediation company, if you didn't let them clean the areas outside the containment, they're not going to come back for free. But if they said they'll clean the whole house free and it fails, it seems like it's their responsibility to come back and re-clean at no additional charge, especially if you told them to agree to that as part of your terms, which I don't think is unreasonable when you think about the amount of money people are spending for this work.
So what is what's safe to bring and what should you absolutely toss? How do you know what furniture and things from your house are contaminated?
We can start with the easy stuff. We know that non-porous is typically easy to clean, so we don't really talk too much about that. It's pretty straightforward. We never tell anybody things automatically toss. That's another trigger thing, by the way, for me, Jody, and Jennifer. If you have a shirt that was in a contaminated room, and there was mold growing over there, and there's a shirt there in the closet, you know, a few feet away, we wouldn't have you throw the shirt away. We'd have you launder it and clean it, but we wouldn't have you throw it away. Can't really do that with a mattress, right? Can't throw that in the washing machine. It's tricky. It's case by case. Is it a $400 mattress? Is it a 15-year-old mattress that you could just replace because it's been time to? Maybe you just do that. Is it that $4,000 avocado mattress that you bought 2 months ago and then you had that water damage event? Oh, darn it. What's the odds? And okay, well, we're not saying you have to replace that $4,000 mattress, but maybe you could take it outside, HEPA vacuum it, beat it with a stick like mom used to do, put an allergen cover on it. There's other sort of more fancy involving processes, involving wrapping it up in actual Tyvek. And there's a couple other things you can do, more involving, more of a pain in the butt, worth it possibly to save a $4,000 mattress. But there's we don't have things automatically thrown away. However, key point, there is a big difference between that conversation, which you can get in the weeds with people and it becomes risk management. It's different for every person and their value and how much money and budget versus bringing it back in, period. A lot of times we will not have people bring in, I don't know whether you clean it or not. I don't care whether it's porous or not. Well, non-porous, some, a lot of exceptions for that. You have a place to sit, but we won't have you bring that stuff back in until you've retested the home and we track your symptoms. So you've had the mold remediation project, you've cleaned it, you tested it, everything looks good. You move back in with minimal contents. It's going to feel like you're in a prison and you're going to treat it like it's a camping adventure and you're going to try it out for a month or so. And then you're going to get with your doctor, Jennifer, whoever you're working with. And you're going to say, hey, can we just like check my levels now, whatever that means to you, and just see where you're at. And if you're trending in the right direction, then you slowly reintroduce those things and you reintroduce them in a reasonable manner. There's no way to cover the thousands of examples it could be, but that's why you would work with an IEP who can work you through it. It's like, well, how about you just bringing your clothing after you launder them first? Do I take them at a laundromat? No, I'd rather you clean them in your own laundry room versus some used laundromat. God knows what's been in those machines. But then right. you can wear those clothing. But it's not because, just for the record, we're not having you doing the stage reentry of contents because we're overtly worried about them. We're doing it because of what we don't know, and we're wanting to minimize the, if you go to bed on Tuesday night after you brought in all of your contents and you react, you're going to blame it on something. And I don't want you to be able to blame it on your contents. I wanted to, you just be able to say, well, you know what? It's just part of my ebbs and cycles when I'm getting, I just have good days and bad days and it's fine. And it's not because of my moldy t-shirt that I thought was contaminated. So the short version of all that is don't automatically toss everything. Obviously, if there's something covered in mold that's not of intrinsic value, go and toss it, throw it away. Or if you've been wanting to get rid of it, that's easy. But those items where you're really hesitant to, don't feel obligated to do that. Don't let the hype get you. We'll just be responsible to how you bring them in. We're not going to have you put a moldy tennis shoe in the middle of your living room on the top of your coffee stand. You know, like, we'll be smart about how it's brought into the home, even if it means keeping it in sealed containers and that sort of thing.
Yeah. And what about small particle cleaning? Does it really help? Is it worth the time post remediation?
A lot of times it's part of the remediation, or maybe that's your point. Yeah. It seems like the industry's changing. It used to be very like, what's the test results show? And if it looks fine, then we won't have you do any cleaning. But more and more we've learned that, first of all, by the time you've tested and gotten results versus what has transpired between that and the time you've done remediation, the environment could have changed again. Second of all, we know there are limitations with sampling. Not one sample detects every known organism in every known state and every known fragment or structure. So a lot of times people will admittedly do some level of cleaning, whether it's that classic small particle cleaning, which really is not sharply defined of what it means. You ask 10 people what small particle cleaning entails, you'll get probably 10 different, similar but different answers. I think what we find in my reality is that depending on what certain test results show is whether or not we'll be willing to have a lesser type clean done, where maybe the homeowner just does maybe a HEPA vacuum in, then followed by like, say, damp wiping versus multiple rounds in the house and treating the air or polishing the air by doing some sort of treatment, whether it's HEPA filtration or, I want you all to hear this clearly, misting for dust suppression, not to kill, that type of misting. We will talk about that. And why wouldn't we ever do the most? Why wouldn't we ever do the Jody, the 100% Cadillac, full Monty? Because people don't want to spend that time, money, and energy to do it. It's a pain in the ass to clean your house when it's that amount of cleaning. And so, again, it boils down to, it's not that you wouldn't want to, it's, do I feel like I should spend that energy to do it?
Yeah, it's all about balance.
Yeah.
So with our limited time that we have left, I've got one extra question, one other question for you that I was like sort of scanning through and seeing like what you've already answered and what we've answered in other podcasts. There was one that I've never heard of this particular thing, so I was hoping you could answer it. The question was about HVAC mini splits. Do the M-Wave filtration add-ons really work?
Funny, I just got done dealing with a house in North Carolina where they have a bunch of M-Waves. This, I believe, is the bipolar ionization units. And whether or not we're talking about I don't know if they make a device that's designed for mini splits in terms of its sizing or not, but let's assume they do. The question then is still, do we think they work? It depends on what you mean by work. If you mean, is there evidence that bipolarization can help break down chemicals and things of that nature, there is evidence and studies that support that. Yes. Do I know that it's doing that to that home? I don't know. Do I think it's removing mold spores or fragments from the home in a reliable manner? It might be helping them settle out. Hard to say. I don't know that there's been sharp studies on that, but I think you just have to consider is what is the effect or an exposure you might have with the bipolar ionization itself. And I don't think that we really have a full understanding of any long-term effects of being exposed to the technology itself. So you have, you know, user beware.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, just to wrap up, the last question that, of course, everybody wants to hear, and I believe we asked you this in the last episode, but it doesn't hurt to have it again, is if you have a list of preferred partners in each state, or if you've got a way, like a quick checklist of accreditations for people to look for. And the person who asked said, because they've talked to families who've gotten quotes from multiple accredited mold companies, and one person will say, this is no big deal and needs minimal work. And the other person will say, burn it to the ground and start over on Mars, you know?
Oh, man. No, there's not a list of people that or a protocol that would separate, or even knowing which one of those two extremes would have been the appropriate answer. I tend not to like the guy that says burn everything down, by the way, in case you haven't picked up on that. But all I can tell you is that go to the organizations like ICI. They're not perfect. I understand that. But you just have to kind of, you know, you have a lot of reasonable heads out there. You have the John Bantas, you have, and again, we've all messed up in the industry once or twice. We're not perfect, but you have myself, you have Larry Schwartz, you have Bill Weber, you have Greg Weatherman. You have a lot of people, you have Linda Eicher, you have Madeline Flagg. These are East Coast girls that I think all have really balanced heads. And I think all I can tell you is if you're dealing with somebody that's like, oh my God, you need to do this, I wouldn't talk to that individual just because of how they're introducing that information to you. I don't appreciate the tone and the context, even if they're right. Even if they're right, I don't need the dramatics. I don't need the effects. You know, just, you know, what's your rationale for it? Why are you saying that? Why can't we sand this down and remediate it? And if they tell you that, you know, because it'll absorb and it's impossible, run from that person. Because that's not healthy way of, that's not how we deal with mold. We don't scare people with things that have not been established or don't even make sense in the environments that we live in.
Yeah. I love that we end that, because it's basically like you're saying, check your gut too, listen to yourself. And we've mentioned it a couple of times, right? Like sometimes you have to listen to your body. Like something can tell you, like a lab could tell you that everything is fine, but your body is telling you it's not. And so yes, it's useful to like try and figure out what you can do to help deal with your environment, but you still have to listen to your body, right? And you still have to listen to your gut. And with mold being such a stressful thing for so many reasons, right? It's financially stressful. It's just stressful on your daily life because you lose access to parts of your home. It's a big stressor. And so working with somebody that makes you feel calmer is probably very beneficial versus somebody who makes you feel scared. I really appreciate that you shared that aspect of selecting somebody.
The last thing I'll say in 30 seconds for you have to let me go is that the industry is aggressively working on educating in a very unique way that's beyond some sort of basic certification that's been established for decades. Keep a lookout for the Cirs X community, CIRSX.com. They're going to be debuting a mold remediation course, and that's game changing. I was one of the authors on it, and it will be helpful. And it would be one of those things where maybe the people listening that have gone and suffered can also be the advocates and the ambassadors to educate people and send them towards that place for education. It's well beyond the basic sort of education and gets into some of these topics that we've covered today.
Yeah. Well, I know from you telling us last time that you may not be able to fly out everywhere to work with every single person who's listening, but that you do have the ability to consult with people, both to figure out some things that they can do themselves, give them feedback on the advice that they're being given, et cetera. That's correct, right?
Absolutely.
All right. So we will, of course, we'll make sure that everything you mentioned that I can find a link to, we'll put that in the show notes, as well as giving people the ability to connect with you for any other questions that they might have, or if they need support in figuring out what to do after a botched job, if they're like really feeling confused and scared and they just need somebody who has a rational approach to making sure that people are safe. And that we are aware of normal fungal ecology and doing everything that we can for that. And then, of course, working with your homeopath or your medical providers to make sure that you're reducing your reactivity to your normal fungal ecology too. Because, you know, you can move, but you can't avoid mold anywhere. It's everywhere. Like I think I mentioned to you last time, like the worst mold experience I ever had was in Phoenix, Arizona. So you, even in Arizona, you can't avoid it.
What, mold in Arizona?
All right. Well, thank you, Michael, for your generosity and for all of your detailed explanation and bringing a really balanced look to this really complex and sometimes scary and overwhelming topic of mold and mold remediation. We are very grateful for you. And I honestly, I hope I never need your resources and your expertise personally, but I also know that you are the first person I will call should I need advice or anything like that. So
yeah, thank absolutely. You again. I'm here. Thank you guys. Thank you, ladies.
Thank you. Have a great day.
We hope you found this episode helpful, hopeful, and inspiring. We try to get a new episode out every week. You can make sure you don't miss any by following us on Spotify or subscribing to our channel on YouTube. If you want to connect with us more, join our Facebook group, Homeopathy for Pans and Pandas, where we have exclusive weekly videos and answer your questions about, you guessed it, homeopathy for pans and pandas throughout the week. If you are already a member, give us a shout out and let us know what you thought about this episode. If you aren't on Facebook and would like to reach us, you can email us at podcast@resiliencenaturopathic.com. Until next time, take care and remember, this won't be forever.